Does everyone have copies of these? Okay, so this class is slightly different than any of the other ones that I've had that privilege of sharing with you. That is, it's not, you know, I don't have like a whole bunch of makoros here. It's more a practicum about preparation for Pesach. And we'll quote makoros as we peruse through the material, but it's really a practicum of dealing with issues of Pesach. And let me just begin by just sharing with you what I consider to be some of the more challenging questions on Pesach, and then we'll go through and why I picked the different things I picked. First of all, let me begin by mentioning that any rabbi who has a shul of any significance will realize that shalom bias issues become more prominent right before Pesach. That's the first thing that you should be aware of. I don't think that this is just a rabbi issue. If you're going to be teaching in a school, or you're going to be a principal of a school, or play a role in guidance in the school, you'll see that there are certain tensions that happen within families that become a little bit more developed around Pesach time. There are obviously two reasons that are self-evident. Number one is the cost of Pesach. You know, poor man's bread at $14.95 a pound becomes a little bit of a challenge for certain people. And the other thing is the additional pressure that people make Pesach into a spring cleaning issue. So the two ways that rabbis, rabbanim, mechanchim, can deal with these issues is, number one, to educate the public that there's a fine difference between spring cleaning and cleaning for Pesach. You know, the Shulchan Aruch, you know, gives us the appropriate protocols how to deal with it. There are certain very good books for Pesach, and then there are certain books that are, you know, that come from the Far Rockaway area that are a little bit more challenging in their issues. And you should just understand that the significance of making people do things that are not halachically required in any way, shape, or form, like, you know, going through cupboards that the last time they went to them was more than a year ago, or going through places where they don't expect to find, or you know, unscrewing the bottom of faucets, and you know, unscrewing the bottoms of pipes and things of that nature, or for screens of whatever, it's crazy stuff of that nature. The bottom line is you really create a situation where you put a lot of extra pressure on families, especially when you have situations where due to other challenges within the Jewish community that you don't have the same amount of stay-at-home moms, the additional challenges that go with preparing for Pesach are exacerbated. So the first thing I just say to you is that don't be surprised that there's additional tensions. And the other thing is, if you know of couples that are having challenges making ends meet during the rest of the year, you can assume that by Pesach it's a real serious challenge. You don't have to wait till they come to you and ask you. There's nothing wrong with you meeting them a month before Pesach and giving them an envelope with a few hundred dollars in it and basically telling them that this is a loan that they should pay back if they can. They don't have to pay it back. If they can, they should pay it back whenever they can, interest-free. Those are always the best ways from an ego perspective to give out money. Not to say this is a handout for Pesach, but rather this is a loan. Use it, keep it for as long as you need it. If you can't pay it back, that's fine. If you can't pay it back, that's also fine. And basically be proactive in situations where you really know that there's a challenge there. That, you know, those are important issues, and I think that we're not sensitive to them as much as we should, especially when we're new in the pulpit. It might take us a little while, as it took me, to be reminded of the fact that these are important issues. So I'm trying to give, you know, share with you something I spoke to Rabbi Goldberg, who took over my position in Boca, and reminded him that he should understand that if he has additional Shalom Bayis issues before Pesach, it's not because there's a full moon out. It's that he should expect that, and that's a standard issue that one should be familiar with. The second most important halachic thing that a Rav should realize is the role of a secretary before Pesach. And that is, secretaries answer more shilas before Pesach than Rabbanim do. And I would ask you to do a blind test yourself. Pick any five or six shuls of, you know, let's say 300 to 500 families, call up and say you have a Pesach question, and the secretary will say, how can I help you? I had a secretary for most of my rabbinate who wasn't Jewish, and she was dealing with issues of Bliya, whatever. My point is that you need to create protocols of what your secretary can answer and what she can't answer, not that she becomes the posek for the community. Secretaries can, I'm not joking, secretaries can become poskim for the community, especially good secretaries that are trying to protect the rabbi before Pesach, when the rabbi is trying to make sure he has a, you know, good Shabbos Haggadol drasha, you know, which we should all take very seriously. Shabbos Shuvah and Shabbos Haggadol should be taken, you know, as they were meant to within, you know, the Minhag Yisrael. Rabbis have all these other challenges besides the fact that they also have families and need to deal, cope with certain issues, and they're the only ones who are definitely not going away for Pesach. So the bottom line is that you should just keep in mind that you need to have a talk with your secretary about what her or his appropriate parameters of answering shilas are or not. The major questions that I have found that I got, and some of them actually, one or two of them are actually new, so I'll give you an example of a new one, is, you know, and again, this is going to sound very trivial, but when a person is dealing with Pesach, nothing is trivial. So I'm going to start with some of the ridiculous ones and then move to some of the more serious ones. You know, Duncan Hines went dairy. There's a whole bunch of people who, before it went dairy, bought like the store out. So this year, people who don't sell Chametz Mamish are asking the Shaila if they can sell the Duncan Hines. So here's where the halachas of Hesed Meruba, Davar Ha'Avud start coming in. And again, I'm not telling you how to paskin on this issue. You all have Rosh Yeshiva and Rabbanim that you should have dialogues with. But even, you know, even people who don't normally sell Chametz Mamish, Chametz Gamor, something like, you know, I'm not aware if my wife bought Duncan Hines mixes or not, but we never sell Chametz Mamish, you know, personally. It's always the minhagim of my family not to sell Chametz Mamish, Chametz Gamor. But, you know, if she had, you know, 50 boxes of Duncan Hines or something of that nature, which people have, so then you're going to get a question like that about Chametz Gamor this year. The other, especially if you're out of town, and, you know, you have this mentality that you have to, you know, stock up on certain goods because, God forbid, you may never get them again. The other issues that have become a little bit more serious is, for example, baby products, formula, which is kitniot. There you have to be careful about kitniot, but the minhag of accepting kitniot, which should not be compromised, contrary to some public postures that certain people have been making about it, kitniot obviously has to be honored, but it does not have to be honored in a case of a chola sheyesh bo sakana, or in any other case of that nature, any child of that age is in that category. And in this case of kitniot, what you do is you basically speak to the parents about making sure that when they rinse, they should buy new bottles, new nipples, especially. Now the bottles basically come with these throwaway bags. So basically, just that's not such a big deal, but they should buy new nipples and stuff like that for Pesach. But the bottom line is, they should be washed somewhere else, not in the Pesach Dika sinks.
against Bato, the robe.
Buck of a Road is not really a bleeder either.
Buck of a Cold.
Well, you're watching the nipples with more than water.
Theoretically, Rico and Ethan
That's a general practice. You're right. So this is halachically, I think you're 100% right. But if I told my wife we have a 10-month-old at home that she could wash the things in the thing, she'd kick me out of the house and wash them. And I remember once in Rabbi Soloveitchik's apartment when we had cold dishes, we put them. There's one sink in Rabbi Soloveitchik's apartment here. Cold dishes, we would put both milchiks and fleishiks. We'd put the cold dishes in the sink together, and then they'd be washed out because there's no bleeding, no issues. So Rav Aaron's wife, Mrs. Lichtenstein, came. She saw that we did this. She threw out all the dishes, and she bought two new sets of dishes. So I remember the Rav saying, "What's the problem? What's the problem?" You know. So she said to him, "Papa, you know, mommy never let you in the kitchen. Don't trafe up our kitchen, basically." And then went over to us and basically said, "You have to." That's the same discussion on a more simplistic level. That's the same discussion here. The minhag ha'olam is that that when you have you just wash the nipples in the bathroom. It's not a big deal. And I would encourage, you know. Another issue that's become an issue, which I gave you some information on, and that is issues of dealing with pets. Right? There's an iser hana for chametz. You can't feed your pets chametz on Pesach. You know, feeding your goldfish masa is going to ensure that you won't have to deal with the problem once the first 2 days of Pesach are over. So there's actually a whole list now that the CRC and Star K and others have put together about pet management over Pesach. I've actually included in that, not that it won't change by the time some of you become Rabbanim, but it's important to see those issues because you will have cases where people will have pets and they will have, you know, halachic issues. Some of those halachic issues will not be able to be obviated through this food system. Let's say you have a pet. And again, for some of us in this room who, you know, don't have pets, will never have pets, or anything else of that nature, we might not view it as something serious. But for people who have, you know, who have pets and stuff like that, this is a really serious, serious issue for them. So there's a nice list of materials, a nice list of foodstuffs. In situations in which the pets, especially older dogs and that nature, that you can't change the diets because the vets will say it's a sakanas nefashos to the pets. So there are times in which people have actually sold their pets to Gayim. I actually remember several times having situations where the pet was sold and at a separate shtar than from the chametz. The pet was sold to the local guy, and therefore the person was playing a custodial role, and therefore you can't. Yes, sorry.
Do you have chametz in your mouth still?
What do you mean?
For the pet food? So that's not a problem.
Yeah, it's not your. You know, where the guy buys the
food and the pet.
Yeah.
Okay. And you can feed the pet, or you have to go to somebody else to feed the pet.
In the cases that I dealt with, we did one of two things. Most of the time, we had the pet go to a kennel, so it was basically done by somebody else, totally outside the house. But I didn't want him. I didn't want the person still to own the pet. And that's how I dealt with the issue. You'll have questions about koshering the kitchen. Those are the major issues of koshering the kitchen. And we'll discuss those. We're going to go through those in here. As you get the stainless steel dishwashers, so, you know, the racks you need to replace the racks. There's some plastic to the propellers that really should be, there's plastic hoses, they need to be replaced. It's critical. Again, this is a very practical session. When you buy a dishwasher and then you don't buy an extra set of racks and you buy the sets of racks later, they charge you as much for the new set of racks as they would for the whole dishwasher. So if you're educating your community about Pesach issues, I was at a, people used to come to me before they redid their kitchens at time and ask me a lot of questions. I'm sure all of you will, some of you may get those questions. You should just realize that you'll indicate to them they should buy extra racks. Liquors are an issue. Sephardic traditions, and even the Sephardic traditions are different between different minhagim of Edot HaMizrach. You'll have time zone issues when you sell chametz, and then we'll go through those in a second. Perhaps the issue of that's totally misunderstood and I think abused is the issue of medicines, where people stop taking medicines because they think there's chametz in them. Quite honestly, the whole idea of having a list of medicines that are chametz and not chametz, when people are diabetic, cardiac patients, anything of significant nature that could have a long-term effect. I'm not talking about vitamins, whatever. You know, it's clear that you don't have to worry about any of those things. A lot of people are worried about toothpaste because it has chametz in it. Rebbe Soloveitchik said that he was not worried about toothpaste. He held that it was not roi l'achilas kalav. I remember once he gave a shiur on that. You guys, I once told some of you guys a story, but he gave a shiur on this. And then one guy took a tube of Crest, went to, what was that, Audubon? What's that street again? Audubon. That with a, like towards the water, no, not Audubon this way. Laura Hill, right. Which actually looks 1,000 times nicer now than it did 20 years ago, believe it or not. And fed a dog, a stray dog there, Crest. And next day came into shir and said, Rebbe, how could you say that Crest is not roi l'achilas kalav? I fed a dog a Crest yesterday. So Rebbe Soloveitchik said, who are you going to believe, me or the dog, whether it's roi l'achilas kalav? So Rebbe Soloveitchik felt it wasn't roi l'achilas kalav. You know, people are machbid on toothpastes. I'm just letting you know that it's not such a simple thing that you have to be concerned about that. We'll deal with cosmetics. The idea of frozen vegetables is a major issue. As you deal with issues of globalization, where plants are used in a multi-purpose way, so the halachas of kashrus become a lot more complicated. So for example, a plant that is doing frozen vegetables could have done something with chametz 2 seconds beforehand, and the kashering process might not be of a nature that wouldn't create a mashahu of chametz still within those frozen vegetables. So frozen vegetables is an example of something that would seem so obvious that it doesn't need hashkacha, but it really does need hashkacha for Pesach. My point of giving you that example is that you need to be sensitive and stay on top of the challenges that happen when you're dealing with globalization and you're dealing with, on a regular basis, new technology that changes things that we would assume take for granted, maybe don't need hashkacha. Yes?
In the frozen vegetables case, would the problem be obviated?
What?
In the frozen vegetables case, would the problem be obviated if you purchased them before Pesach?
Once it's, except what happens is, because it's being batel, whatever, but first of all, we don't rely on that with hachila, and I don't think we should be educating our community to do that, but I think another issue is that their mamish, when I buy the frozen vegetables and I open them on Pesach, if they went through any cooking process, obviously there's a problem. But if they didn't go through any cooking process, and I open them on Pesach, and there's a chance that there could be chametz mamish within those vegetables, you know, there should be a problem with that. Right?
I mean, I think Ashkenazim also worried about a whole different name. The Rambam makes a difference between last halach and yavish b'yavish, that even if it's bottled before Pesach, so it could be that on milk we rely on it,
right,
as lach halach,
right,
and it's not supposed to
be
there.
Would this even be a taro then?
Huh?
It's a little kernel, and then you have the broccoli.
It's probably a taro because it's very hard to notice. I mean, they won't sell you frozen vegetables with like a little, like all those kids in Shabbat, like a piece of wheat that you find in the chicken, you're not going to get that jet.
Right, but you will get, we're mocked that frozen vegetables should not be that one should buy frozen vegetables with hashgacha. I mean, it's not like we live in a time where it's not a real problem anymore, so we should buy frozen vegetables with hashgacha to obviate the issue of concerns that we have, that there'll be chametz, you know, thrown into these vegetables. Obviously, the issue of milk, of buying either milk beforehand or making sure that milk has hashgacha that allows it to be used for Pesach. What? Because the issue with milk is twofold. One is that the milk, I've heard two different concerns about it. First of all, on Pesach itself, if the animals have chametz feet, that there's a problem. And the other thing is that sometimes that's the major issue. So you buy milk, and the other thing is, have you heard that again? That
I mean,
sometimes
no,
the milk.
It's the issue with the chametz feet,
right.
an animal that's fattened up from Yisuri Hanoah.
Right,
this
you
is
can't
the article I wrote about veal ones. An animal that's fattened from Yisuri Hanoah.
Well, I mean,
even if they eat it before Pesach, so it could be its entire life. Well, if you're using the chametz of Shmuel Avos, which we're usually machmir for, so
right. So we normally do is we buy either there's hashgacha on milk that's kosher to Pesach, and they're making sure that the feed is not a chametz feed, or what? Or guys, let me just. What happens is that. Or what happens is that you buy milk, you can buy milk, or what you do is you freeze the milk before Pesach, and you can use the milk throughout Pesach. So look, that will be discussed a little bit in here, okay? Let's look at this preparation for Pesach booklet here. So this booklet over here, a first part of it is something that I put together many years ago for the shul, which please feel free to totally steal. And if you want, I can give it to you in a Word form so you can mama steal it. But actually, this was done in WordPerfect because I think when I did it, I wasn't using Word. You see what this does is I send this out a month before Pesach to give people an overview. You know, the prohibition of chametz, what is chametz, kitniot, medicines. And you can see the names have been changed here to Rabbi Goldberg and Rabbi Levitt now because obviously it's appropriate. But if medicines are being taken due to serious health related, one should continue to take them even if they're chametz. Mechiras chametz issues. I indicate how I don't think that they should be sold beforehand. They shouldn't be sold. Preparing the home for Pesach. How does one prepare the home? And let's get to preparing the kitchen for Pesach, which is on says Passover Guide, page 7. Here we deal with the issues of Kabbalah, Kach Polto, and can only be done on Kalim that you have the capacity to kosher. But first of all, it's a nice thing to do that you don't have people kosher their own Kalim for a few different reasons. Number one is I don't think people kosher them properly. So what I arranged was that actually at the local JCC, when they were koshering their kitchen for Pesach, they made a few hours available, and it was staffed by myself or other mashgichim who basically koshered the kitchen. They koshered the kalim for everybody. You can do that in your shul. You can make it available that people come and they kosher their kalim, and you watch the process. I have to also tell you that I found that Pesach is a really good time. You when you do mechiras chametz and stuff like that, it actually is a time for you to get to know people in your shul that you don't normally interact with. Rabbanim normally interact with two groups of people in their shuls, the ones who are having all the different challenges and the ones who are playing leadership roles. And the middle group, which is the largest group in a functional shul, Rabbanim really don't have interactions with, here and there's a shiloh and things of that nature. When you do mechiras chametz, you do these issues, it's really a time of the year where you actually get to see everybody. There's nothing wrong with spending a few extra minutes saying, gee, how are things? Sometimes they'll actually tell you how things are, and it might be more than a few minutes, but it's a good time. And sometimes you should keep a list for yourself of people that you've interacted with that you really need to follow up on, you follow up after Pesach. But I found that to be a very good portal of entry, so to say, interacting with people. So I want to go through the koshering of the kitchen because I think that's one of the issues. Gas, it's pretty obvious. You clean the whole top, the spiders, the cups, the slide out trays. You wait 24 hours, in a Benyomo. You invert the spiders so that they are on the highest flame for an hour. And then you cover the range top with aluminum foil. This is not talking about if it's a glass top, the metal top. So that what happens is that if you take a pot and you put it on the side of the stove, there is a separation between the normal chametz stove because of the aluminum foil. The electric is a similar idea. Also cover the entire range top. I prepared a brief video, which I actually made copies of, to give everybody, but I'm not doing it because I reviewed it with Rabbi Shechter yesterday and one or two questions on it, and I'm not prepared to give you something that Rabbi Shechter has a question on. But I want to just speak about a glass top for a second. They're very hard to kosher. And that's what most people have, glass tops. So the easiest way to kosher it is the following. If you turn on the stove tops, and you leave them on, they'll get to a Lieben Gomer of 950 degrees or so because of the redness. But the problem is, what about the rest of the stovetop? How do you move a pot off the stovetop and people by accident might put it on, on the surface, which has not really been koshered. And there you also need to do Lieben. And I have a way of doing Lieben, but which I'm not going to fully articulate now because I'd like to suggest a much more simpler way, and that is simply to have trivets. If I wash down the stovetop, and what happens is then I have trivets. So if I have to move the pot off the stove and I put it on a trivet, I don't have any halachic problems that I'm putting it on the stovetop that hasn't done a Lieben Gomer. If you do a Lieben Gomer on your glass-topped stove, you'll have no halachic problems because you'll need a new glass top stove. There are people who actually have two different tops that they switch for Pesach and for a thing, but it requires you to have a degree in electrical engineering to switch the tops. But the trivets is perhaps the simplest way for one to be able to take take it off and to put it on. There's a whole shiloh of how you kosher glass. Is it cheres? Is it this? Is it that? Does it need Lieben Gomer? Does it need Lieben Kal? If it needs Lieben Kal, how can we get it to Lieben Kal? There is a way to get it to Lieben Kal. The shaila is maybe it needs Lieben Gomer. Maybe Lieben Kal doesn't work because in cases in which you're worried that you're going to break the vessel, there's a whole then even Lieben Kal doesn't work. So without getting into how you do Lieben on the glass stovetop, which is extremely complicated and not something that I recommend, out of the box, trivets are the simplest way to kosher any type of stovetop. It's not koshering it, and you've created another mechanism. There are some people that I know of that have glass tops that what they do is they just buy burners for Pesach, and they don't use their stovetop. Not everyone's going to do that, but... Then you'll just need a new one. You'll need a new. In fact, there's even a question. There's a whole, they even warn you about using a blech on there or anything on there, because it can crack the glass, right? So that's for a stovetop. Now the ovens themselves. So self-cleaning oven is the best, easiest thing because your mom is creating an unbelievable heat source where you're basically, you're leaving gummer for sure. Use a 3-hour cleaning cycle and you've more than covered any of your issues. Gas, continuous cleaning, clean the ovens and shelves thoroughly with oven cleaner, do not use for 24 hours. And turn the oven up to broil for an hour and a half. And if you want to use the broiler, you have to use a disposable broiler tray. Put the broiler pot away. The regular broiler tray should be placed with chametz utensils, unless you're going to kosher it with a blowtorch, which is not, it's not recommended. The microwave, the glass tray itself I think is problematic to kosher. Most microwaves, the funnels of the microwave don't get hot. You can, cook something in your microwave and then put your hand against the wall of it. Clean the microwave, let it sit for 24 hours, put a vessel with water into the microwave, allow the water to vaporize into steam. The duration should be the longest time you've used your microwave, and the glass tray should be put away. A convection oven is a little bit more complicated. Convection oven is an oven that has a cell, it's like a regular oven, but it has a moat in there that has a fan that cooks in a more rapid way. So what will happen is that there will be food particles, sometimes behind that convection fan itself. So what I basically do is, and that's also important, by the way, when you kosher a self-cleaning oven, the frame around the door itself sometimes will have be'en in it. Now sometimes after it's gone through convection, self-clean, basically the be'en will be destroyed. It won't be roi l'achilas kalav, it's nothing. But I always, just wipe around the frame of the oven before I put on self-clean for Pesach. Here you have a situation in which what I've done is I'll just unscrew the guard around the fan. I'll clean out the fan if there's any debris there that's chametz stick. Then just screw it in. It's not a complicated thing to do. And then I'll run the self-clean cycle on the convection oven. Yes?
You have to wait a full day for a self-clean cycle?
No, because self-clean is not... Self-clean is momish. It's such a hot thing. It's like creating a new kli. It's not the same. No, you don't have to.
But you still have to clean up the fan.
For the convection thing? Yeah, I do. If I don't, in that case, what I do is I normally put a little bleach with a Q-tip around those areas, so I'm poking that area. Or you can wait for 24 hours. Okay? That's another thing that's important. When you kosher, obviously we all are aware of the fact that koshering works after it's eino ben yomo. So some rabbanim have tried to come up with a patent, especially when Pesach is right after Shabbos, that the people want to, so let's say Pesach is Sunday night or something like that, or Monday night, so let's say Pesach is Monday night, so they'll start koshering on Sunday and they'll tell people to bring in their cups that they used on the kosot they used on Shabbos. So they won't have 24 hours since they were used, they did Sunday morning. So one Rav did something that he thought was very smart, was he was poging the water with bleach. By poging the water with bleach, he obviated the issue of eino ben yomo. The only thing he did was he destroyed everyone's silver bechers because the bleach tarnishes the bechers. So yeah, he obviated the halakhic problems, but at the same time he destroyed, 100 bechers. His contract was still renewed, but the bottom line is that it's not something, it's something just to keep in mind, those basic issues. You have to be careful. I mean, I don't know if anyone here is going to be doing serious koshering for Pesach. You'll use blowtorches in hotels and things of that nature, and you use a blowtorch in an oven. These ovens, and you become more blowtorch happy. Sometimes what they do is they destroy. Most of these ovens have these very sensitive thermostats also. And what you do is when you use a blowtorch, you bust these thermostats, and therefore the ovens become not usable. There isn't a year that goes by that there isn't ovens that are destroyed. You don't have to replace the whole oven. You just replace the thermostat. That the thermostats aren't compromised. In a house, you do it in the way we're focusing just on the house. Refrigerator, just clean it out. No big deal. People have made mistakes in these refrigerators that they cover the shelves. What happens is you cover the shelves, especially the shelves that have, if you notice, especially in the freezers, the shelves are not whole complete shelves. The shelves are basically bars. That's for there to be appropriate airflow. So somebody comes and covers the shelves, you all of a sudden on Pesach, all the food in the freezer starts to melt. they don't understand why. By doing this, from thinking about putting shelving in your freezers or in your refrigerators that have that type of shelving structure, namely that it's not complete shelves, but rather ribbed shelving, you destroy the airflow and you compromise the integrity of the refrigerator with the food in there. So don't be surprised if someone says to you, you know, Rabbi, I remind people about this issue because, again, the last thing you want is people to compromise. And I wrote that in here. Pesach foods are entered. Be sure the material has holes in it that allows free flow of air necessary for efficient use of a refrigerator. Dishes and utensils. Only certain dishes can be kosher for Pesach. Anything that's a kli cheres can't be. If one has chinaware that hasn't been used for several years and it's mamish very expensive stuff and the family has certain financial crises, here's where it's important to realize there is a chazanish about how you unkashers fancy chinaware, and that is inserting in hot water in three different vessels and then washing off with cold water. I only allow there to be kashering of this type of stuff if the family is a family that I think it's a financial difficulty for them not to be able to buy, you know, a special set of kosher Pesach stuff. There's a list on page 8 of things that can't be kosher. It's pretty self-evident. And here you see on page 9 what I said before about how utensils can be koshered at the Federation campus between 8 and 12. It should be 8 and 12 p.m., not a.m. I don't think they were open that long. Reminding you that you should wait 24 hours, reminding you the volume of the water should be 60 times the amount of the stuff you're putting in there, explaining how you can kosher a pot if it doesn't fit into another pot, and that is you heat up the water and then basically take a red hot stone that's dropped into the pot so that when the water is boiling, the rack roaring boiling, by dropping in the stone and the water going over the sides, the stone is not cooling down the water. Glass utensils, again, I would only do that in cases where people really can't afford it, and you'll see I wrote that in the language in a nice way, in which the only cold chametz was used can be kosher, however, it is strenuously suggested glassware exclusively for Passover be bought. Countertops, there's a whole bunch of questions here about it. Basically, if countertops don't have abrasions and everything else, and no one's putting their food directly on the countertop, pour boiling hot water over them, I think that's sufficient. Then the pets for Pesach issues, Bedikas Chametz is pretty obvious, the Kochamiras. Then there's a little explanation about the Sedarim, which we don't have to go through. Let's look at the form for Chametz on page 15. Okay. I always had the principle, and I'm not suggesting that anyone who does differently is wrong. I came to a community where I had a certain responsibility of building the day schools. So I had my own little discretionary fund that I helped pay for tuition assistance and stuff like that. I used the money that is normally gotten on Pesach, I used it for that. In other words, people would know that I wasn't taking the money for myself. The money was being used for that. I'm not saying that everybody has to follow that protocol. I personally think it's cleaner for a rabbi to go to the Baal Batim and say, I'm not taking money, you know, for hachnasa of these issues, but rather you're paying me a salary. I want it to be a decent salary. And realize that I'm not, they shouldn't think I'm trying to nickel and dime them throughout the year. And therefore, I would explain in a very nice way on the form that the money basically was not going to me, but the money was going to what it really says up there. Now, the form itself has important things to it. Obviously, your name, your address, and everything else of that nature. Also, where the chametz is located. The value of the chametz, the value of the liquor. Keys. If you were away for Pesach, you had to leave the keys by either a neighbor or by the shul. Because the guy would go into two or three homes every single Pesach. Normally people that gave me a hard time during the year. But no, two or three people. And would basically have the opportunity to participate in her chametz. This was my way of making sure that the whole community knew that this was real. Because rest assured that if the non-Jew came with the rabbi to one or two people's homes and basically tasted a little bit of the chametz or just opened the cupboard where the chametz was, you know, everybody knew about it before the end of that night. And it was my way of making sure that people realized that, you know, this is not just, you know, something that's not done. And here, the other thing is time zones. If you're in Israel, you're 7 hours ahead, you know, whatever it is, 7 hours ahead, your chametz needs to be sold earlier than you sell the chametz for anybody else. So I would make sure that I would do a work, you're in different parts, any parts of the world, or for that matter, if you own chametz in other parts of the world where Pesach started earlier, I'd also sell the chametz based on that location. So if you were if you had a house in Australia or something of that nature, so I'd have two sets of mechiras, one that was done normally like the night or the afternoon before, and then one that was done at the standard time, in order to obviate any of the mechiras chametz. You know, that's the way I would sell the chametz. The next page of this handout is, again, I just put this on there only to just show you. You know, we printed times of when people could go sell their chametz, so people knew exactly when the expectations were. Trust me that it does not stop that 5 minutes before Mechiras Chametz, there aren't 20 people who forgot that they needed to sell their chametz. It still happens. I once asked, I'm not sure if it was Rabbi Willig or Rabbi Schechter or Shaila before, I'm not even going to quote what they said because I don't remember it, but I remember them figuring out a way in which I could even, if people, there was one time I had a shy, it was more than one time, but one time I wanted to help deal with this issue where I had already sold the chametz and then somebody sent in a form if there was a way of me trying to deal with it. I think Rabbi Willig helped me deal with that issue at one point. Here's a very important letter from the CRC. Very important letter. This is a response, again, to other publications that come out, which we already mentioned. All pill medication, with or without chametz, that one swallows is permitted without special hashkacha. Vitamins and food supplements do not necessarily fall into this category. Please consult your rabbi regarding specific situation. All liquid and chewable medication that have kidney yolks may be consumed by one who's ill. However, a healthy person who has only slight discomfort should consult with a reliable list for approved medications. All liquid and chewable medications that have chametz or questionable chametz should not be used. Look at all varieties of body soap, shampoo, stick deodorants are permitted for use in Pesach regardless of its ingredients. Not Roy Lechilas Kalas. All types of ointments, creams, nail polish, hand lotions, eyeshadow, eyeliner, mascara, blush, foot and face powders can be used without ingredients. We just took out around 100 pages of a book. Colognes, perfumes, hairspray, shaving lotions, other things that could, you know, have real alcohol in them. So that you should check that out. Lipstick, toothpaste, and mouthwash, they felt that contain chametz should not be used. And the people who signed this, you know, are respectable in their orientation, in their nature.
Deodorants?
What?
Deodorants is right, like color?
Right, so again, I'm not suggesting that deodorants, you know, if you go to, I once had this discussion, someone said, if you go to the Lower East Side, you'll see drunkards, you know, people, whatever, who'll use that to get high. Whatever, what?
Also find the dog in Little Hill,
they
eat toothpaste.
Right, right. So right, it's not a normal thing.
I've heard people drinking mouthwash, because mouthwash is heavily alcoholic.
Whatever. But the my point is right. You're scaring me. So my point here is not to focus on the things they said you need hashgacha for. You should speak to your Rosh Yeshiva. Gentlemen, you should speak to your Rosh Yeshiva and ask them. There is definitely enough, you know, it's clear that in my opinion, deodorants are not considered Roy Lechilas Kalos. There's nothing to worry about them. quite honestly, I'm not worried about the toothpaste either. But my point here is that there are so many times in which people have momish put their health at risk because they've checked and they're taking something for cholesterol, and it's chametz stick, and they don't eat and they don't take it, where clearly those issues aren't an issue. And there are people who go out and buy all these new perfumes, mascaras, and everything else like that for Pesach. It's just an extra hardship that's not required. And I feel that this is a very important letter. And it's not a letter that has, you know, last year there was a letter like this, but before that there was never anyone who wrote something like this. Maybe next year we'll get one that will have the shaving lotions and hairsprays and other issues. Also, my point is, it's important to recognize the fact that all of these pills and stuff like that, you don't need to worry about. Yes?
Regarding Atilas Kelev, do we run them actually check it out, or what do they do to actually...
I think it's a normative, I don't think they check it out. There's a standard protocol, standard understanding of, you know, where it's... The idea of suggesting that deodorants are bottle, you know, that who drinks deodorant, things of that nature, is one of the reasons why they would not be concerned about deodorants. Regarding issues of pill medication, I think that it's clear that pills, it's not a chila anymore. It's not food, so there shouldn't be an issue either. Also true about all these mascaras and things of that nature. It's not food. So therefore, even if it has chametz in it, it's not an issue.
So how I'm just wondering how we gauge, like, Atilas Kelev.
There's a truth in the Sholem Meshiv about rat poison.
Oh, yeah?
Whether it's from Atilas Kelev.
And what is it?
Rat poison.
Yeah? And?
So in that shiva, I don't remember the details, but the Sholem Meshiv goes through how he determined that rat poison was in fact right after it was cut off.
What?
Yeah, he was mocking rat poison for some reason. Uh-huh. The later poskim weren't so into this.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
In that shiva,
so
I
was that to combat roach traps, you can't use them on Pesach. That's
yeah.
Probably.
Oh, yeah?
Same.
Where was that? When you see that?
Staten Island. Whatever they sent out.
I don't know. Now, I have in here a few, I think another issue that's important when you prepare for Pesach, gentlemen, everyone with me here, I think that it's important that you realize that one of the ways you prepare for Pesach is preparing your congregants. And what has not yet happened, maybe somebody in this room will do it, and I think you would do a great service for the Jewish community. Every single kashrus organization prints their own list. God forbid that we should have some general list that everyone would print together. So the OU has a list of its products, Star-K has a list, the CRC has a list, the OK has a list, the Chav-K has a list. There's not one list. So what I normally do is, the OU, actually if you're an OU shul, they'll send you, you know, their OU list. And then I always print out, now you can get it online, the CRC and the Star-K list is very good. Even though they're very focused on their own products, they're also a more general nature. So if you see here, I photocopied part of the CRC list for you. You'll see it speaks about different Passover products, things that you can get that you don't have to be worried about at all. You know, everything of that nature. You see where it's, you know, indicating all this stuff. Does anyone see the CRC Passover product guide? Then it speaks about cosmetic toiletries and things of that nature that one doesn't really have to worry about. Then medications. And then, in the middle of it, page 11 of 13, it says in stock, you have now your pet foods. This is very important. So it gives you your cat pet food, your dog pet food, your fish foods, your bird foods, your hamster foods, page 11 of 13, page 12 of 13, page 13 of 13. So, again, if you don't have pets, it doesn't really bother you at all. If you do have pets, it's a big issue. Then the Star-K has a list also, and that's this list that I have in front of you also, star-k.org, and it's star-k.org. This is also a good list. And again, it's pretty sad that there isn't one list that everyone just puts together. Maybe we'll try to do that. Because everybody just has to use all these different lists. Oh, by the way, raid and bait are titnio space and do not need to be put away for Pesach. Okay. Look at the star K, page 58. What?
Okay. I look at the answer
as far as that. Then the last page of the handout is the Shtar Mechira for the Nachri that I wanted to do. But does everyone understand why I put these pages together like this? And my point is that you should really make sure that in your shul, see, the problem also is these are never ready like by Purim time. Like they're always ready like, you know, 2 weeks before Pesach when, but you do the best you can. The Vod of Detroit, which has an excellent list, that one will be ready probably Monday. You know, there's a time issue here also, but you just use the ones you can. But I would suggest that everybody who's going to have pulpits or Machansen who are going to give out information, you know, you have the OU list, you have the CRC list, you have the Star K list, which now, and you deal with the pet issues, and you put out your own little thing that allows you to tell people how to kosher their homes, gives them some highlights of things they need to clean and what they don't need to worry about cleaning, and creates a koshering opportunity within the synagogues / other community place. If you're part of a kollel, it's a nice thing to do. Part of a school, it's a nice fundraiser to do, or something else of that nature. It just also allows you to monitor and help and teach people how to kosher effectively. Does anyone have any questions on anything we just said before we go any further? Yes?
At some point before we're done here, could you do like a mock mechira? Walk us through all the steps for selling to a guy.
Sure, I'm actually going to try to do that now. Okay? But the truth is, the best thing to do for that is, I remember I used it many times. I always hazard my mechira. This is the only year I haven't hazarded it, so I'm a little uncomfortable doing it. Rabbi Willick has a great video. What I'm going to do is actually, I have a copy of the video. I'm going to actually put it on DVD, and I'll give it to Rabbi Schwartz, and you guys should have copies of it. It's a great, great video. It's simple. It's, you know, it's just whenever it explains it, it's always good to have it. I always, even though I've been selling chametz for 20 years, and the video is not that old, it's maybe 10 years old or 15 years old, I always look at it before Pesach just to remind myself of going through all the various kinyanim, because of all the whole shaila of which kinyanim work with Gayim and not, and therefore you try to do as many of them as you can. All of them, actually, you try to do. Okay, yes?
Where did you find your Goy?
In my case, it was it's a member of the synagogue staff. It used to be my secretary, until she re... my secretary was a guy, she wore a shetel. So I remember once, Rabbi, yeah, she, whatever, she liked wearing a shetel. But she was a guy, trust me. She was an Irish guy. And I remember once, one of the first times that the Rabbi Schechter and Rebbe Schechter came, so Mrs. Schechter saw that she was wearing a shetel. She started asking her like certain questions about the community until I had to explain to her that she's, you know, an Italian guy who just happens to wear a shetel. But there was always somebody in the staff of the shul that wasn't Jewish. And I would, you know, explain to them the issues. Rabbi Willig, I think, has a manager, apartment manager guy? He manages apartments?
I think they lived in the building.
Yeah. Right.
Mr. He has enough money that he could really afford all the chametz.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm not the person that.
Do you also use quarters?
I use some because of Rabbi Willie, because he didn't want it to be paper, right? So you'll see it's in here, but I don't. I use dollars also, but okay. So. Let's read this agreement, and this is the way we'll get to it. Now, there's the standard. Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
I have another question. On seltzer, it says here, any unbelieving seltzer may be used, and the question is also for certain sodas. I once learned that in a course about beer making, and beer making you have wheat and yeast and all kinds of stuff, and it produces a lot of carbohydrates, and that is formed, and to there's carbohydrate in beer because it bubbles, right?
Right.
It's a lot of sucrose of that stuff, and they sell it to factories where seltzer and sodas are produced, and they put it in their drinks. I wonder why it doesn't have the
mine is no. I think the seltzers, because the seltzers are produced in plants, and we should only produce in seltzer and nothing else. But in the Coca-Cola plants and stuff like that, like in Florida, there's a Hollywood, right near Hollywood, there's a Coca-Cola plant. So we basically do it for the OU. We have to kosher out the entire plant, and. They use a different sweetener for Pesach, and there's actually the sweetener, because it's otherwise normally the sweetener is a kitnia sweetener, and if you actually do this, if you take a Coca-Cola kosher for Pesach and you pour it, you'll notice that the fizz on the whatever is much more substantial. In other words, you know when you pour soda, sometimes you have to wait for it to settle before you can fill up a cup. If you notice a kosher Pesach soda, there's a lot more that needs to settle because the sweetener is a different sweetener. To the point in which the Coca-Cola people told me that was the original way the Coca-Cola was made. So there are people who are not Jewish that are aware that the sweetener changes, and they order the Pesach soda in mass quantity to help them for a few months afterwards. But I don't think I think with the seltzers, it's not an issue.
Especially with the seltzer, you might only produce seltzer, so
right.
Seltzer is basically clean water, and then you add the bubbles, but they need the bubbles from somewhere.
Isn't it a carbon-based...
Yeah, but the carbon, I'm saying, could be a byproduct from beer.
I'm sure the STAR-K and the OU and the CRC, who all agree on that issue, have all checked it out. I mean, it's, you know, people walk into these soda plants and the seltzer plants on a regular basis. I'm sure they checked it out.
Reverend.
Yes.
Why is it necessary to change the sweetener? Isn't it butter baroque?
Well, again, what? Does
it gives flavor.
What?
It gives flavor.
Right.
But butter baroque. No, that's when you say butter machichin. It gives flavor. Butter baroque. It's clear. It's butter.
Listen, I again, first of all, I think that we're not... We don't automatically run to Bottle Barrow on certain issues right away. In other words, we're going to try to make sure that we don't have to follow. We don't have to be summit on that. When all you have to do is change the sweetener for the soda. That's number one. Even if it's halachically, it's an acceptable issue. What?
Isn't it also
right?
Is it about liquor? You know, the same thing would be true, maybe.
We're making this a little bit more sophisticated than it needs to be. The Jewish community, it's the same thing as washing the nipples for kitnios bottles somewhere else. The Jewish community is going to want want to make sure that it's chametz free, even though there could be maybe an issue. First of all, I don't know how they make the soda. I don't know if the Matzias works that way. But let's assume for our discussion that the Matzias works, that they really don't even have to change it. Because it's bottle, it's this, it's not. It's not going to fly.
The OU's policy is that they will never give hashgacha. I only know from the OU. They won't give hashgacha relying on bittul at any time.
Yeah, so we never.
Hashgacha means I'm saying this is 100% kosher.
Right.
If this, now it could be in your own kitchen. You're relying on bittul, but
no one's going to give hashgacha. I'm not going to be comfortable signing my name to hashgacha for Pesach for the rest of the year when there's an inyan of bittul, and. It's not, but I want to, when, I'll give you an example. There's a whole machlokas regarding the notion of chazara on Shabbos, right? It's a machlokas bavli in Yerushalmi, right? You have the shita, you know, the machlokas bavli in Yerushalmi, what the definition of chazara is on Shabbos, right? Is chazara that I took it off the stove on Shabbos, and then I returned it to the stove on Shabbos? Or is that not chazara even? Is the definition of chazara that it was on the stove Erev Shabbos, and in order for me to return, and then I want to return it to the stove on Shabbos itself? Machlokas Bavli and Yerushalmi. You have the Shulchan Aruch brings down the different shitas. So Rabbi Soloveitchik followed the sheet of the Yerushalmi. Even though I think there is somebody who says there's a Taos in the Yerushalmi, the Efei Naim I think says there's a Taos in the Yerushalmi, and I once showed that to the Rav, and he said, you know, he knew that Efei Naim before I was born, and he still follows the Yerushalmi, and he wrote protocols for Maimonides school, which I have a copy of, that actually says, that follows the Shita of Chazara according to the Yerushalmi, not according to the Bavli. In my house, I follow the Shita, like Rabbi Soloveitchik said, when it comes to a Davar Yavesh, because that's where he felt it. Now, it's not really such an issue anymore because you have hot plates. But when we initially got married, that's what we were doing. But when I give Hashkacha for the ORB, even though I never allowed that approach to be the one that was the protocol of the ORB. Not because I was trying to suggest that Rabbi Soloveitchik's Shita isn't as good as anybody else's, but if the Olam is no hey, that's not their definition of Chazara. I don't think when you're giving a supervision for the Jewish community, you should do anything less than what the community is, you know, no hey. I think that's true when you give Hashkachas in general. I'm not going to, even if you can say Bithel and everything else of that nature, and everybody, you know, just took your day and can figure out how it's 100% kosher, it's still not a comfortable thing for one to be doing. It's, you kosher the plant, use a different sweetener, and call it a day. If Coca-Cola doesn't mind doing it, and the Jewish people can live without Coca-Cola for 8 days if they didn't do it, there's no reason in the world that you have to come down to, I don't want to say the kulas, but halachic constructs that don't need to be used, and you can simply be totally Pesach-tick. Okay? I think that should guide you in the way you give Hashkacha. Now, that doesn't mean that if, you know, a hotel calls you and there was a mistake they made and it happened before Pesach and Bithel works, you know, and things of that nature, that you have to tell them to throw out $100,000 worth of food, then you could use the issue of Bithel. But in a normal case, when you're trying to create protocols, you should never, I don't think you should ever use issues of Bithel in the way you construct halachic kashrus for a community. Let's look at this document here. Agreement is made on this and this day, corresponding to this and this day, before this and this time, between the rabbi, whatever, or the Boker Tom synagogue here, or the Young Israel, whatever, hereinafter referred to an agent, and this and this person referred to as buyer. Whereas certain persons whose names are set forth upon certain inventory sheets, delivered herewith to the buyer, herein referred to as sellers, are desirous of selling all chametz owned by them, and in which they have any interest whatsoever. In other words, what I do is, every single person has a form, like I showed you here, it's attached to this. So there's an inventory of the person knows exactly where she, in this case, where her chametz is. Whereas each of the said sellers have designated, or appointed, and empowered rabbi so-and-so as their lawfully designated agent to sell, transfer, and dispose of all such chametz in such a manner and in such terms as said agent in his sole discretion shall deem appropriate. And whereas the buyer, her and above, identified, is desirous of purchasing all of the said chametz of the sellers in accordance with the terms of the agreement. Now therefore it is agreed upon by and between the agent as agent for the sellers and each of them and the buyer that the agent hereby sells and the buyer hereby purchases all chametz belonging to each and every one of the persons herein referred to as sellers whose names are set forth upon the individual inventory sheets of each seller. The term chametz is intended to include all leavened products of the five types of grain, wheat, rice, felt, barley, oats, alcohol. And by the way, I always make sure that she takes a little schnapps, preferably the single malt one, at a person's house. Fermentations of any of these grains or any admixture. I have one druggist, actually. He has a drugstore that's open on Pesach, and he actually, and he needs to have, he has chametz sticka stuff in there. So there's a tshuva for Moshe Feinstein where it says you can actually sell it, you can have a Jew sell his chametz even if he's gonna do gezel from a guy, because it will obviate the Isser of Kares. But what I've done, actually, in that case, was the following. We figured out, let's say, it's Hershey's chocolate. Let's say the rent for the store for where the Hershey's chocolate bars are sitting is $10 for the month, for the week of Pesach. And the Hershey's chocolate bars make $15 over that time, $15 of profit. So $10 basically goes for the rent of the location, and $5 has to be paid to the guy. So I actually have people, I take this very seriously, this mechira. I think it's a mistake not to. And what happens is that I trust the store owner, he does an inventory of whatever chametz he made money off of, less the rent of those locations, and he pays the guy, because it's really the guy's store, and the guy deserves to get paid for that. Did you say that?
Say it again. Can you just repeat it again to make it seem clearer?
So, in a case in which, first of all, the Tshuva of Moshe Feinstein says the following. If there's going to be a store that's going to be open that's owned by a Jew, even if the Jew's going to sell chametz on Pesach, it's better still to do a mechira with the Jew, even though it's really gezel from the guy. That's number one. So that's important, especially in an out-of-town community where you want to deal with the chametz she'avalav Pesach issues. Number two is, in cases that I've been involved in, where, for example, there's a Jew who owns stores, and they were really serious about the mechira, they have figured out what profits they made on the chametz d'gestaf over Pesach, and they've paid those profits to the non-Jew, because it's really the non-Jew's stuff. And if there's profits being made over Pesach, the Jew doesn't deserve them. It's the non-Jew who deserves them. He sold his chametz to this non-Jew. If there was profit made over Pesach to this chametz, the person who deserves that profit is the person who owned it at that point, which in this case would be the non-Jew.
Was the area of the store also rented to the non-Jew?
Yes, well, that's in this document. Okay? Yes.
Can the actual owner of the store take payment for doing the work for the goy? Like, I told her to actually get, like, X percent.
That's not the way I worked it out, that if there was a, if let's say there was a whole shelf and it actually, you know, per square foot, there's a rental fee, you know, you can take that off. But that's all, nothing more. It doesn't come out to a lot of money, you know, but it's an important statement. Yes?
Why don't you have to go afterwards to be more public?
Because I want it to be real. You know, I want it to be something that everybody realizes is real, and I want this guy to basically realize he has to fess up and he has to pay up. He did a mechira; it's a real mechira. Everybody views this as smoke and mirrors. There's even Yiddish jokes about it. This is not like mechira's chametz. I'm supposed to do a real sale. You know, I want people to think that it's real. I want people to take it seriously. I'm sure there are 1,000 ways that you can get out of it. I just want people to take it as a real thing.
Usually, does it end up being a lot of money?
It's a few $100, maybe. It's not the point. The point is that the guy needs to do a cheshbon. He needs to figure it out. He needs to do this. It's, you know. Yeah. I mean, the chocolate bars, it's not the chocolate, you know, it's other stuff. Because the chocolate bars will take off he won't sell. But let's say there's other things that he can't take off that he needs, you know, for an older person who walks in and stuff like that. And it's indicated that it's chametz because we don't want the Jews to buy it there. But, yeah, I want to make sure that he takes it seriously. Okay? Now, in order to effect the sale, the buyer agrees to pay the agent the sum of the estimated fair market value of the chametz as determined by 3 recognized experts according to the accepted market value prevailing today in Philadelphia and which shall be paid by the buyer as follows. $1 per person right now, the rest on and before the, you know, and you do it like after Pesach, right? Yes.
Who are these 3 experts?
No, that you don't. It would be people who are experts in food stuff, and they would evaluate exactly what it's. If the guy says at the end of Pesach he wants to buy everybody's chametz,
so
he needs 3 people to right. the reason why I make everybody give me what their value of hummus and value of liquor is because I actually have my secretary tally it up so that we have real numbers of approximately what it is before the real, before the three recognized experts actually, you know, would do anything, you know, would check it, okay? $1 per person right now, the rest on or before, you know, let's say Pesach ends April 20th, you know, April 20th at night. The understanding is that the sale is absolute and effective immediately, and the balance due is considered a debt from buyer to seller, the non-payment of which shall in no way affect the validity of the buyer's title to the chametz sold. Risk of loss and loss of value are borne by the buyer. In addition, the buyer gives an item of personal property to the agent, chalipin. They shake hands in accordance with the custom of sales. These additional methods of acquisition are employed because of questions about the effectiveness of each method. I didn't want to write effectiveness. I got this, by the way, I got this, I fixed this a little bit for myself, but it wasn't, I don't want to take ownership over something that, I got this from somebody else, and I just fixed it up a little, you know. I just wanted to do something in English so that everybody, you know, there's the ones you can buy in Yiddish. It's a good chance the guy didn't really understand it, so I figured that I wanted to have something that everyone understood. It is emphasized that each sale and method of sale is independent and therefore unaffected by any invalid sale or method of sale performed in this agreement. Now there's another issue, and this you have to be very careful about. One or two guys have tried to be cute and they sell their own chametz, and they've really messed themselves up because they come over to me and say, Rabbi, we didn't need you this year. We went to our local guy in our store or our workplace. I sold him the chametz. I sold him the kalim. I sold him everything. And I said, great. So after Pesach, since you sold him your chametz and your vessels and everything else like that, now all his vessels required to be tovelim. So now he needs, you know, to hire 20 guys to tovel. So let's go through everything here. And it is further agreed that the agent, in behalf of each seller, hereby leases to the buyer the closes, cabinets, storage rooms, garages, basements, and other areas in the premises of each of the sellers where the effort described chametz may be located, including the location specifically enumerated upon the aforementioned inventory sheet, and including further any other locations within the premises of the sellers where such chametz may be found. In the event that any of the sellers may be tenants of the premises that presently occupy with respect to such sellers, this provision shall be intended to convey a sublease of the areas where such chametz may be located. The duration of the lease is from the time, is from Pesach time. Again, it'll be a little bit earlier when I do Mechira number one, which is for people in Israel and things of that nature. Okay? In other words, someone's in Israel and they have a house in Boca Raton, a house in New York, and stuff like that. I will make sure that the Mechira starts before Pesach starts in Eretz Israel. In consideration for the foregoing rental provision, the buyer agrees and hereby does pay the agent an additional sum of $1 for each enumerated seller. So if I have 1,000 sellers, you know, there'll be $1,000 per person and $1,000 per location. And then we do another. We do also a handshake and a kinyan chalipin also to be able to rent these places. By dint of the execution of this rental agreement, the buyer who acquired ownership of the after described chametz, which is hereby transferred to him in the best legal form, agav, further by the virtue of the buyer's rights, etc., of kinyan chatzer. So what I basically have done here, the mechira has used all different forms of kinyanim, because there's a machloket which kinyanim work by a Jew, and therefore kinyan chalipin is the quintessential kinyan, but we use all of them so that we are finding all different ways of making sure we do the mechira properly. Now the truth is that most, I think, rabbanim, they don't do anything after Pesach. I actually go to the guy and a minute after Pesach is over and basically ask them if they want to finish the sale or not. If they don't want to finish the sale, they have to return the deposit. If they don't want to finish the sale, then I return the deposit to them. and they are four, and then it ends. And then I'll call the pizza shop guy to tell him he can start making pizza. But you know, the bottom line is, most of the Yiddish one, the Yiddish agreement, I'll put in the announcement that you can't use your chametz until an hour after Pesach, which is more than enough. I've done everything already. The Yiddish one, if my memory serves me correctly, actually has it basically, if the guy doesn't, it becomes like batel mevatel, the cell immediately. I was never comfortable with that. I, you know, to the best of my ability to make this real, I make it real. So, you know, what happens is it ends right then and there. So I remind everybody that for the first hour after Pesach, they shouldn't use the chametz. Okay? Does anyone have... Yes, please. We'll just close this way. Yes, please.
Does the cell cover any chametz bought on Pesach accidentally?
No, I can. No.
It's only stuff that you own at the point of.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
You actually have $1,000 bills if you change back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not all we. And depending how many people have. Yeah. I also have coins also. Because Rabbi Willig has this whole thing that you should use coins because it's mamish kesef and not the thing. So I basically use dollars. Yeah.
You have 500 people selling you $500.
For the rent and then $500 for the thing.
He gives it back to you for the rent.
He'll give it. What happened was, what I'll do is, it'll be his money, or I'll give him money before her money beforehand, and it'll be their person's money. And the person at the end of the day always makes money off it. The guy always makes money. In my case, I always make sure that they make some money off of this.
How much?
I don't know. Whatever. What happens is, I give them money for their services, you know, but basically what I do is, they have, let's say I have $500. So I give them, so they'll have $500, and they'll have $500 for the rent, $500 for an initial deposit, my brief. And what happens is, then they have to, and we'll go through we'll effectuate all the kinyanim that are here. So they'll give me money, that's one kinyan. We'll do kinyan chalipin, they'll shake my hand. There's a kinyan chatzer by renting the location. And that's, you know, that's what we're doing. Right, because I do two sets of kinyanim, one for the chametz and then one for the.
And you do the kinyanim after you sign the document or before you sign the document?
Before, and then I sign it right in front. We both sign it together. That's it.
And the answer means I give the money back.
Yeah.
How is he able to go back to steal?
There is. It says here that what does it say? It says, in order to affect the sale, the buyer agrees to pay the agent an estimated fair value of all chametz is determined by three recognized experts prevailing today in whatever and should pay the rest on or before. See where that number two is? So I go to them on or before. I'm going to them that night of Matzei Pesach and say, do you want to continue the sale? If you do, you owe me $1 million. If not...
The time you put it is like a minute after...
It's actually a little bit more than a minute. I can only put it at, you know, the amount of time I drive to the person's house. So I, you know, I put it 45 minutes, you know, after, a half an hour after. It says on or before. That's why I did it like that. But I always put it a half an hour before, something like that. And then I do. I actually go there and I do the thing. You know, my wife says the reason why I do this is because she and the children have to do the changes from Pesach, and I come home and it's an hour and a half already into it, and I'm whatever. But I want to really make this. I believe in this being, you know, which makes this as serious as possible. Yes.
Why do you have to rent it this way?
What?
Why do you have to rent
it? It's a different form of a kinyan.
On the
chametz itself.
So
then I guess that kinyan won't be one of them that you're using, but you have a whole bunch of other kinyanim that you're using. Yes?
Let's say we were concerned about a smasa, that I'm not writing too much money in the tefillah because no one's going to pay it.
Right.
Like, do we ever find a concern about that with your summit? That just, we know anybody's not going to buy it?
Not that I'm aware of. Right, that's why he doesn't. But he can afford it. Doesn't mean he's going to do it. I mean, he's a smart businessman. By definition, he's not going to do it. There's a better chance that my secretary's going to do it. What? Right, that's, you know, that's why he's very well. Yes?
How exactly do you explain to the non-Jew how this all works and what you're doing?
I mean, I have a history of 15 years with the person, so, you know.
So how was the first year?
The first year is, I sat down with the person, I explained them Pesach, explained what it's all about, I explained to them the idea that we're not allowed to own chametz, explained to them that if people, and the person, and you know, we don't really try to keep the real chametz, we have a, you know, food pantry type of thing where we try to give it all away beforehand, but there's substantial losses, and therefore what we do is we sell it to a non-Jew, if they're more than welcome to keep it, or they can just sell it for a few, you know, keep it for a few days. The first time the woman was very nervous because she thought, you know, she wanted her lawyer to see it because she thought she was going to have to pay, you know, millions of dollars afterwards, no matter what the issue was. And I explained it to Rachel Bekazakana. I really said, I explained that we do all these kinyanim. I don't say because we're not sure which one works for a guy. We just said these are all ways of concretizing this fleeting relationship in a concrete way, and therefore I want to do all to fulfill the obligation for all the standards of the Bible, and normally they're very, you know, accommodating. Yes?
How did you handle the risk of loss or the loss of value or borne by the buyer when they come and drink some schnapps? Do they have to pay for the schnapps afterwards?
No, I never really dealt with it. In other words, you know, I assume that the person's not makbid, you know.
Sorry.
What? Yeah. I'll keep that in mind for the future. I never really dealt with it, and to be honest. And my point of doing it was, I just wanted people to know that, like, I was, you know, try to do it seriously. Who else? Yes.
Is it the difference of the goy is one package, or could they say, oh, I'll keep this person and sell
that? Yeah, they could do that.
It's not, it doesn't come as like one large lump sum where if you want to buy something.
I've never had that issue. Normally, you know, they see that there's $1 million or $100,000 or whatever, they'll, I don't know. I assume that they have to buy the whole thing. That's what the document says. Chametz of all the sellers. Yeah, I don't think they can just buy one. Anyone else? Yes.
How is the shul janitor going to be able to afford $several thousand?
It's not the shul, first of all. It's not a shul janitor.
He's Jewish.
It's a secretary. She has money. She has, you know, she has a, no, she's a little bit, you know, she's a little bit, you know, senior in her years. She has money put away. She owns a home. She owns other things. She can afford it if she needs to pay it. No, most rabbis just use like a local guy somewhere who has no thing. You know, Ray Willig is very careful about that issue. I, you know, this is what I try to do. I think it really, really is pretty detailed. It's not this Hebrew document that no one knows what's going on, neither the rabbi nor the person. It's really clear, and I think it at the same time it allows the you know. It allows the guy understands what his or her responsibilities are. If the guy wanted to get a loan based on all of this stuff, chametz, the guy could get a loan because it's real stuff. I give them an inventory of every single location of every single thing. The guy could go to a bank and say, "I want to buy all this chametz and stuff of that nature." Jewish banker. I mean, they get a whole inventory. I'm not just not smoke and mirrors. They get a loose leaf. They get a binder, 500 pages in the binder. They get the whole thing. I keep a set, and the person and the guy gets a set.
So you would call Maria a week before. Value. So there's how much you need to bring to the office when we do this.
Right. Well, we're at a point already that she figures that out already. I don't even have to make that. We're past.
She's going to
right.
Perfect
form. Right, that's right. She's going to perform. She tells me how much you have to bring. Right. What's the hardest part is, again, about making sure that you sell the chametz at the right time. In other words, the guy in Israel who has a place in New York, he's not coming back. You can matzei chag, you can still buy back his stuff, even though it's 7 hours later for that person. But if you sell it 7 hours into his Pesach, he's been chamish avar lava Pesach. So you really have to make sure. That's the trickiest piece of this puzzle, is that it's not one sale. In most places, it's only, two. Yes?
No, is the sale retroactively bought, though, or is it you're actually buying
back? I actually buy it back. In other documents, there are says retro, but I actually go there. It says honor before, so the truth is
so that's the issue.
I go and I say, do you want to continue it? Even though I don't think you have to.
Excuse me?
The first
it's not a problem, but when they don't continue it.
Yeah.
It
no, because it says that, read the document. The document says you own it now, even if you know. Right, everything else is just a loan. Yes.
Do you do more kinyanim when you buy it back?
I actually do. I do a kinyan chalitin, and I do that, but I don't have to. All I have to do is, if she doesn't want to continue the sale, it becomes this over. I don't have to do anything. I don't know why. What?
The first year, can you tell her up front, by the way, I'm leaving, I'll come back and buy it back, or are you going to do
it? I explain the both. There are two roads we can travel.
Right.
I explain to the road less traveled, but I explain to both roads. And it's up to her. Yes?
There's also an issue with buying and coming back, pays off to somebody else, and if the guy's...
No, it's not, because the guy's in Eretz Yisrael.
No, let's say the guy's in L.A., and you're here.
Right, so I won't actually, that one I'll buy back the next day. Yeah. I will have a separate document for that person. I'll have a separate document for that person, the LA guy. Or I'll come back, I won't drive back 3 hours later or something like that, but I will do it the next morning at work, I'll do it. But I'll call the guy, that's a good point. I'll call the guy and say, I want you to know I'm not buying back your chametz until the next morning. Because who knows if the guy took a red eye and he comes in at 8 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning, he starts eating his chametz. It's not, he's over in Issa Gzela. So I will make those before Pesach. The person will get an email. Now, it used to be phone calls, but now thank God emails. It's a standard email. So because you're in LA or whatever, your chametz will not be billed back to the next day. You could only start eating your chametz after 10 a.m. or 9 a.m. I'm just giving an example. Those are important. That's why this is not the standard one, which did a whole bunch of makoros, but you have to do it like that. I sweat over the piece about, I'm always afraid that I miss somebody and I'm gonna after 120 years, I'm gonna have to pay for it. So I like forensically look through those documents. And that's why I have that thing there about filling out that form. And every time I do mechira, I like star the top of the stop of the form, just for me to know that that's the one I have to pull out.
So yeah. Do you take back less money from your secretary?
I actually, yes. No, I'll do a separate shtar for those. In other words, those might only be two people like that. So I'll do a 500 one and a 2-1 and whatever. I'll do a separate one for that. I'll do it totally separate.
Okay.
It's too complicated for me. I'll do it separate. I'll do one Thursday, let's say Pesach, I'll do one the night before, I'll do one on the day, I'll do one, if I have to do one, it doesn't always happen, I'll do one the next, to do the next morning type of, I'll do them separate, just easier, yes.
When you buy it back, you pay more than you originally received? Is that like how you make it
reply? When I buy it back, I'll buy it back for the money, I'll get the money back. And then after I finish, I will give the person some money and say, I want to thank you for for the time that you spent in this and as a token of our appreciation, whatever. But actually, what happens is there's so much part of the community, and not that I ever asked for this, they actually donated back to the Chesed Fund. Because she understands what the Chesed Fund does. As my secretary, she knows what it does, and she wants a chelek in it also. Yes.
Well, you said you buy it back and you get the money back, but you meant you give the money back.
Yeah, I meant to give the money back. But I'll give them and then I'll thank them for a little. Yeah.
You give the token of your appreciation. Could you comment this is also the color of the single malt?
I should have, but I didn't, you know.
But that would work.
I would assume it would. Why, no. Well, no, it's the opposite way. It's the opposite way around. I should take less. No, it wouldn't work.
No, I mean, I'd give you another.
No, she's not paying for that.
She's saying, I'm paying you another $5, but remember Leslie?
Right. No, I never took it to, you know, I never thought about it. Okay, we'll stop here. Okay.